This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Sandy Hook, Aurora, Colorado, Blacksburg, Virginia, Columbine, San Bernardino, Orlando, Charleston, now Las Vegas. Those are just a few of the most well-known mass shootings in America in recent years. Sunday night's massacre in Las Vegas was the deadliest in American history, but mass shootings occur in some form in this country with shocking regularity. According to The Guardian, there were six other mass shootings this week alone. 1,516 in just 1,735 days. That equates to one mass shooting every 9 out of 10 days on average. And that's because mass shootings are identified or defined as 4 or more people shot in one incident, not including the shooter. Those shootings with fewer casualties don't get much notice, but the big ones get all of our attention for a short period of time. We hear talk about gun control, about mental health treatment. We talk about public safety. We mourn the dead, and then we move on. And nothing ever seems to change. So the questions remain, why is this happening at all, and why is it happening with increasing frequency? What, if anything, can be done? How do we make sense of these things? Dr. Frederick Lemieux may be able to shed some light on all of this. Dr. Lemieux is a criminologist and professor of the practice and faculty director of the Masters in Applied Intelligence at Georgetown University. He joins us this morning from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And we are also joined once again by Cindy Combs, an expert in terrorism and homeland security and professor in the Department of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to the program.
Morning, Mike.
Good to see you again. Dr. Lemieux, let me begin with you. 2 years ago, you wrote an article called Six Things to Know About Mass Shootings in America, the purpose of which was to debunk some of the common misconceptions. The first thing on your list is this. More guns don't make you safer. After each of these events, the stock price of firearms companies seems to go up in anticipation both of increased sales and perhaps the fear that we're going to control gun sales in some way, shape, or form. So what has led you to say that more guns don't make us safer?
Well, in fact, you know, the study of statistics, not just in the U.S., but around the world, mostly in advanced countries, industrialized countries, shows that availability of guns tends to increase overall, first of all, overall death by guns, overall homicides, and overall mass shootings. So the fact that guns are easy to access, countries with what we called permissive law, meaning that they allow people to get gun easily, that it's the government that has the burden to show that people are not are not suited to have a gun. In those countries, you see more homicides, you see more deaths by gun, and that includes incidents or accidents with guns, and of course mass shooting. And the reverse is also true. So in countries where you have restrictive gun laws, meaning that people have the burden to show that they deserve the rights or they deserve the authorization because they have like good character, they can buy guns. So if they prove that they can be reliable, then in those countries you see less death by gun, you see less homicides, and you see also less mass shooting.
We do a lot of talk in this country about the shocking number of murders that we experience every day. In Charlotte, we have a rising murder rate here that is very troubling to a lot of people. And yet it seems that more people die in mass shootings every year than they do from murder, from homicide, what we would consider typical homicide. Why do we concentrate on murder but not on what kills more people?
That's a good question. I think that the fact that it is individualized, like murders are, you know, like not that sensational anymore. They are part of our, you know, day-to-day life. You know that in the U.S. last year, we had a little bit more than 11,500 homicide by gun in the U.S., which is like, if you compare that to, you know, like one of the good friends, you know, UK, it's nothing. It's nothing. And even if you just said, oh yeah, but we have like more population in the US than in UK, even on a rate base, even if you put that, you know, homicide by 100,000 inhabitants, I mean, we're still off the chart, with homicide. But the thing is, it's more sensational. Like mass shooting are more sensational. But even there, like just don't take what I'm saying at its face value. Look at the small mass shooting. Those who are like, you know, four people, five casualties, six casualties, they don't even barely make it to the news now. We just don't pay attention anymore. I was giving an interview yesterday to a radio station in Montreal, and they said, well, we stopped covering them. I mean, until they are like, you know, significant. But they are stopping just covering what's going on in the U.S. in terms of, you know, mass shooting that are, you know, like less, let's say, than 12 or 15. We kind of created, you know, slowly that threshold in our mind.
Cindy Combs is here from UNC Charlotte. We've talked about various aspects of mass murder in the past. What's your take on this? Why do we seem so focused and so upset by individual homicides that happen here in other cities like Chicago around the country, but we don't really add up the death toll here and get and wring our hands about this? We just don't. If this incident in Las Vegas had happened 30 years ago, this country would be paralyzed this morning.
Part of it is because we look at the homicides as statistics. You're looking at one or two a day. Homicides don't gather international or national attention. They don't even make it, he's right, to the newspapers. So,
is that because of frequency or because we've just become inured to
that? I think we've become kind of inured to the idea. Other countries haven't. And if you look in other countries, if there is a single homicide, it makes it to the papers and it becomes an attention. But not necessarily in countries like ours where we have homicides daily in multiple cities all over the country. Mm-hmm. So we become inured. And there's an amplification effect that the media has to some degree on it, because when we focus on something, it becomes important. When there are when there's 24/7 type reporting out of an incident, mm-hmm. it becomes important.
And this gets back, I think, to that paper that I referred to at the very beginning of this program, Dr. Lemire, that six things you to know about mass shootings in America. Number one, more guns don't make you safer. Are our numbers in terms of shootings, mass shootings or murders or otherwise, higher strictly because we have this huge number of guns, both legally and illegally purchased in America? Or is there something else at work here?
Well, I think there is difference. You know, there's many explanations. First of all, you know, compared to many other countries, what is interesting in the U.S. is you have this kind of individual entitlement to defend yourself. It's very deeply anchored in the culture of this country that, you know, defending your home, defending yourself, you know, like you have the right to do that. And this is not the reality in most Western countries, where this prerogative of defending yourself is given to the state. Like even in Canada, for example, where I come from, if you kill somebody, you know, defending yourself, or somebody that, you know, trespass your property during the night, you are most likely to be charged with manslaughter or something like some, or, you know, secondary level homicide or something like that. Where in the U.S., like the castle rule or those kinds of dispositions are kind of, you know, in line with what people expect in terms of, you know, self-preservation, self-defense, and things like that. Second of it, it's also legally embedded in the Constitution. You know, the right to bear arms is there. It's a protection, which in most other in all other Western countries, it's not incepted in their constitution. That kind of disposition is not there. So, I mean, you have those. And, you know, I was also interested by trying to find a proxy measure. It's not in that paper, but it has been published in a peer-reviewed journal. And, you know, like I did expand that study about, you know, mass shooting in different countries around the world. And I tried to see, like, is there an appetite for violence? Is there a cultural, like, interest or, you know, like entertainment or something that, you know, is proper to this country or countries that have more mass shooting or more homicide. And interestingly enough, I did not find a causal relation, but I found, you know, a correlation between countries that are producing more movies with gun and gun violence and the availability of guns, the guns ownership, and death by gun in those countries. So more you are into, you know, like interest, you know, by movies. I'm pushing that a little bit far, but my interest in that study was to try to understand if there is something that is culturally like enable that, or is there like a, you know, like a collective interest or fascination for gun violence?
Well, we have this frontier mentality here because we're a frontier nation. But also, if you watch primetime television for any length of time, once you get past the sitcoms, it's pretty much crime and crime procedural. Cindy,
part of it is that we're blurring the lines on exactly what this right of self-defense is and the right to bear arms. In other countries where a citizen may be able to purchase a gun, they're very specific on self-defense. It is defending your house against someone coming in. A machine gun is not a defense in a house against a break-in. We have the access to semi as well as automatic, and the little small adjustment that can be made to a semi to make it automatic, making this kind of weapon available for self-defense in a right to bear arms in a frontier. We've blurred the lines. It's not a clear right to bear arms if you need to feel the need to protect your family, as it is the ability to be able to take something that can kill massive numbers of people.
And you've talked about the correlation between the guns, the number of guns, and the number of murders and or mass shootings, Dr. Lemieux. But let me just provide some numbers that appeared in that article that you wrote. In the United States, in the 20 years from 1983, or the 30 years from 1983 to 2013, we had 88.8 guns per 100 people and 78 mass shootings. For comparison, Germany had 30.3 guns per 100 people and 7 mass shootings. France had 31 guns per 100 people and 6 mass shootings. These, on the face of it, seem to be fairly eye-opening. Why aren't we paying attention to that?
Well, it's a good question. I think that, you know, there is a... Again, I go back to the culture. I go back to, you know, the too well-known, you know, line of those who defend, you know, the right to bear arm is, you know, like a gun will stop another person with a gun. Somebody with a gun will stop. And that's what this is, a kind of, you know, a vicious circle in which we are stuck now in this country, where when, you know, like when you have incidents like that, and I'm just curious. I mean, maybe I missed something in the news, but I did not see yet the NRA response or a statement from, you know, what happened in Las Vegas. But now, I mean, it becomes very foolish to in this particular case to make the try to make a point of saying that somebody with a gun in that mass of people could have stopped the shooter. I mean, it doesn't make sense anymore, but we still kind of buy in. Mm-hmm. And just to add on that, I mean, tell me why we are continuing right now to witness lawmakers considering pushing through a bill that will allow or will deregulate the access to silencers for weapons. Could you imagine how that would look like yesterday in Las Vegas when the shooting happened on
Dr. Frederick Lemieux, criminologist and at Georgetown University, will continue in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing private wealth management teams of local advisors to help navigate the life clients have built and help prepare for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. More info at suntrust.com/reserve. NWTVI PBS Charlotte's Carolina Impact, highlighting issues shaping Charlotte's development and changes that can affect and reduce the city's growing pains, tonight at 8:00. Well, the Supreme Court's back in session with possible cases that could impact the Carolinas. On the docket, a gerrymandering case in Wisconsin that could have implications here, and of course, the Rowan County prayer appeal that we talked about yesterday. The country has been talking about race, and President Trump's comments about the NFL in Charlottesville and gun control has taken center stage again, for obvious reasons. Our go-to political scientists will gather here tomorrow to dissect all of this on this program beginning at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, terror in the streets of Las Vegas. How should America understand and confront the now drumbeat of mass killings in this country? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Obviously, we are talking about the events of Sunday night in Las Vegas and the fact that this is just another in a series of mass shootings. This, of course, the largest and most deadly mass shooting in American history, but only temporarily, because this replaces another one that's very recent, and the availability of guns, and why we seem to be paralyzed in terms of doing anything about this. And we'd like to hear from you as we go through the hour. You can reach us all the customary ways through Facebook and Twitter and email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we'll take your phone calls this morning, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. Before we go to Elizabeth and Charlotte, Cindy Combs, this was news. Let me introduce our guest again. Excuse me, Dr. Frederick Lemieux, a criminologist and professor of the practice of and director of the Masters in Applied Intelligence at Georgetown University, and Cindy Combs, professor of political scientist and a terrorism and expert and homeland security expert at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Lemieux just mentioned that there is this bill before Congress to allow silencers, have ordinary people put silencers on their guns. Now, the only thing I know about silencers, Cindy, is that they're in all the gangster movies from the 1930s, so you can't hear the gun go pop when you off somebody. Why are they considering allowing people to have silencers, and are they illegal now?
Now it's not something that is normally sold to. When you buy a gun to buy a silencer, you have to have a special permit, I believe, in most places. The difficulty is, for a lot of people, the issue of shooting causes mass panic wherever you shoot. And the idea of a silencer is that you would therefore not create the noise and the chaos. I've heard some of the rhetoric behind the law, and it doesn't make a great deal of sense in terms of security issues.
Okay.
Convenience, yes. Security, no. But it is popular among a lot of the gun advocates.
Okay, I'm going to take a couple of phone calls, and then we're going to go back to Dr. Lemieux, and I want to talk about terrorism this morning, too, and because Dr. Lemieux mentioned that we have not heard from the NRA, and I believe that is correct. We have not heard from them yet on this issue, and the other thing we haven't heard about is terrorism, and I want to find out why from you, because you're the terrorism expert. But first, let's go to Elizabeth and Charlotte. Welcome. You're on WFAE.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So my comment would be, I think, Dr. Lemieux, I think your study was very interesting, and especially when you broadened it to cover things like films and movie media and how that's affecting population. But what I see is a lot of different studies that are created in silos. So you have people and professionals doing a study on, you know, the psychology of mass shootings and the criminology of mass shootings. But I think that as a country, we probably need to look at some sort of root cause analysis that compiles all of the data and all of the analytics so that we can look outside of the silos and see what we are potentially missing.
Doctor?
Yeah, there is what we call, if you want, some meta-analysis, meaning that there is a couple of studies out there. There's one that has been published in 2016 that did not bring anything new to the table, but did what you are discussing, did put together several studies that have been conducted, compare them in terms of strength of methodology, the type of data sets that they were using, and so on and so forth, and not just apply to the United States, but also apply to other countries, like studies that have been conducted in Norway, in France, and in Germany. So, while the United States is experiencing that on a almost daily basis, the rest of the world or the rest of the researcher communities around the world are not seeing that as a pressing, I would say, topic, because it doesn't happen elsewhere, just here. So, but you're right, there's efforts that are right now underway to collect those data, to show them, and I would be, if it's an interest, and maybe if it helps your listeners to read more into that, I would be happy to share that reference with the show host.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't have the full title but it's a handbook on psychology of mass shooting.
Okay, well, you can give that to us, and we'll post it on our website at a later time so that people can find. That's perfect. I said in the beginning of the program that these mass, and you just said that these mass shootings have become more frequent, but the number of murders in the country, except for outlying areas like Chicago and even in Charlotte, murders are on the decline. And in fact, in Charlotte, even though our murder rate is rising, it is lower than it was 25, 30 years ago. So at the same time murders are declining, mass shooting numbers are increasing. Do we understand why?
Well, no, that's the thing. Like I would not say it's a new phenomenon, but the acceleration of it is certainly something that, you know, we're facing right now. And in fact, a study conducted by public health Harvard researchers have been demonstrated that the frequency increase, but also the time in between mass shooting is reducing. So they happen more frequently and more rapidly. But we don't know yet why. Some studies have said that, okay, media publicization coverage doesn't help in terms of, you know, copycats and things like that. But it doesn't explain the whole phenomenon and also the increase.
But the shooters involved in these mass shootings, at least the big mass shootings like the one in Las Vegas, Columbine, San Bernardino, they always, always, always end up dead.
Yeah.
What is, knowing that, what keeps these things continuing? And is that also the case in the smaller mass shootings, which are defined as any four or more people, not including the shooter? Is that the case in those situations as well?
Well, I think that there is also, we have to point out the mindset or the mental state of those individuals. In many cases, if they end up dead, it's because they take their life, or, you know, they are like going into a final battle with police officers and they get killed by police. Very rarely they get captured alive. And the thing is, it shows the mindset that, you know, many of those individuals, when they go onto that, goes into, like, they know that it will be it. Very often they have, like, plans for after what they will be doing. So they are on a suicide mission, or they are, you know, like, and one of the motivation we can see is on some of them, it's vengeance. Many of them, like, especially if you remember, like, the episodes back in the, I believe it was in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, we had an expression in the U.S. saying going postal, where you had a couple, you know, several incidents in post office where disgruntled employees were coming back in postal office and just killing their employers and colleagues. So we had those kinds of, you know, like, motivation where people were looking for vengeance, were looking for, they were disgruntled and things like that. But we also have, like the shooting at Aurora, this kind of fantasy of being, like, you know, a character, or, you know, like, kind of, you know, exposing, or, you know, like, going for, you know, like, an expression of power, or, you know, like trying to express yourself in a certain way where you will be remembered, mm-hmm. or something like that. Those are difficult to understand. You will probably need a psychologist to better explain the mindset of those individuals. But that's true. When they go in, they rarely come back. Like, that's, they know that it's their final mission.
All right, let me bring William in Statesville into this conversation. William, you're on WFAE.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wondered why we can't handle the gun situation basically like we do automobiles. To have an automobile on the road, you have to have a license that shows that you know how to operate it safely. We have different classes of those. You could have that for guns, handguns, you know, rifles, more powerful things. And you have to have insurance, and you have to have the vehicle registered, mm-hmm. show that it's in good shape, etc. Why can we not do that with guns?
Cindy?
And some of these folks that want to say, you know, more guns is safer, if that's the case, why don't we legalize all sorts of other things that, you know, let's legalize hand grenades. They'll make us safer. Let's legalize, you know, anti-aircraft guns. They'll make us safer.
All right. Cindy.
William, those are good questions about why we can't. But if you look at what happened here in Las Vegas, the issue was not a matter of a man who should not have been sold a gun because he passed all of the basic tests.
Right.
He was a good citizen. His neighbors said he was a peaceful person. He had no criminal record. There should have been nothing that he couldn't buy. What we lack is any kind of mass registry that says how many guns have you bought and how much ammunition. That's the kind
but
of flag.
If you register all that stuff, that's, you have some sort of record, and you can have some sort of sense of that.
But
we
is there
people
that,
who have
no.
300 cars?
The difficulty is there isn't a mass registry of this. You do, in fact, have to go.
But he's advocating for one.
I think that's a good idea because that's one of the things that would be the one flag. The one thing we know out of what happened in Las Vegas is that the one unusual part of this, he had an arsenal of weapons.
But we have something.
Absolutely.
We have concealed carry here,
yes.
in many states, and you can't conceal carry your car. But you can conceal carry a gun. So if you and usually when you buy a car, there is a record of the transaction. There aren't always records of the transaction when you buy a gun because there is a black market for guns. Is it possible, really, in the scheme of things, to control these much smaller articles?
It's possible if we want it. If we want it badly enough, we can do it. We have the same problem with automobiles. It's not a matter of registering the car. It's drunk driving that makes automobiles, most of the time, a very dangerous weapon.
William, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Liz on Twitter says, are you going to introduce the elephant in the studio? The NRA, she says, is the legal cartel of the United States. What's your take on that, Cindy? You're the terrorism expert.
It's not a cartel, but it is a strong voice in the issue of gun control. And the fact that they have said nothing says up front to me that they are concerned about public reaction to this, how strong there will be a push for any kind of registration and gun control. Mm-hmm. And they're smart enough to wait and see how the winds are blowing before they try to step in. So not surprising that they aren't saying anything yet. You can't assume they're going to stay out of the argument because it is fundamental to the issue.
Dennis in Mooresville says, just another well-regulated militia. He's quoting the Second Amendment there. Just another well-regulated militia member exercising his Second Amendment rights. A precedent-setting Supreme Court case has led us to where we are today. What does he mean by that?
The ability to bear arms has been defended, and it is true that we've had serious questions of ourselves about how far that right goes. That's how you have limits to some degree still on automatic weapons. But the right to bear arms is fundamental to our Constitution. The difficulty is, like some of the earlier constitutional statements, our country and our culture is changing. We're not in a wilderness trying to defend, and should not be a system that depends on creating individuals who are going to be the local unorganized militia. Although that is also defended in our legal system. So we have literally allowed the arming of everyone if they feel the need. We're very reluctant to change that culture. But we should be willing to put flags up that says if someone is creating an arsenal, that is a danger. Mm-hmm. If that's the only thing we saw in his history, we should be have been looking at that.
Well, as you point out, the killer in this Las Vegas situation has no criminal record whatsoever. He has a parking violation,
yes.
A single parking violation.
Yes.
He was as described as a gun enthusiast, although his brother was surprised that he had so many guns. I think they found 43 weapons between
total.
Those in the hotel room and those he still had in his home. He had a ton of ammunition.
Thousands of rounds.
He had explosive devices, and all of this came as a complete surprise. So, Dr. Lemieux, once you get a firearm, even if we heavily restrict the purchase of that arm and we keep very close track of how many arms you have and how much ammunition you buy and whether or not you are qualified under whatever set of qualifications we set up under new restrictive laws, there is absolutely no way to control how you ultimately use that weapon, is there?
I mean, let me backtrack a little bit and come back to those, you know, like dispositions and what the U.S. need. First of all, it's a management of its gun problem. You know, like, of course you will never stop somebody that is very determined to do a mass killing. He can take a knife, like, and you will have people telling you that, like, we got some episodes in Europe. We got episodes of, you know, knife mass killing in Japan. Those exist, of course, but they are rare, very, very rare. And the point being, if we want to make a very good or a better analogy that with cars, in this particular point is we know that we are monitoring on a daily basis people's traveling within the U.S. on airplanes and outbound and inbound the U.S. on airplanes. We have massive amount of data that we are monitoring to just discover any red flags or any, you know, abnormal patterns of behavior on, you know, purchasing tickets and so on. So we have that capacity because we decide to give ourselves the tools and the management systems to do that. So being able to monitor people's buying or people's, that could be a first step. A second step is when you're purchasing a gun, you usually walk away immediately from the gun store. In other countries, when you purchase a gun, you have to be cleared. You have to be revet. We have to check your background again. And you just don't walk away, I mean, with a gun. That could have been proven, like, interesting prevention measure in the Navy Yard in D.C. a couple of years ago when the individuals bought a gun a few days before in Northern Virginia and walked in a naval base in Washington, D.C. and gunned down several people. I mean, there's disposition. I'm not
well,
saying that
but,
all
but,
those...
But in Las Vegas, the gun store
yeah.
where this gentleman bought a number of the guns that he used, they did background checks and they have a personality profile of him, and they say he met all the criteria. And I know that you have said that background checks work. Would they have worked? They didn't. It didn't work in this case. Would they have worked with Dylan Roof in Charleston or the killers in San Bernardino? Do they work? Why do you say they work?
They work,
about a minute.
They work because they will probably, like, when you have about 80% that have shown mental illness issues, in background checks that are taking that in account, background checks that, for example, require that your spouse or former spouse, you know, get an interview or sign or refer you or give you something, that will also, like, help the authorities to understand the character of someone. I'm curious to see what his wife or former wife that is now traveling has to say about the individuals. And, you know, maybe she knew more than the authority. Maybe there's something more to know about him that we don't know yet. Maybe we'll discover things on his, you know, social media. But what I'm saying is, if you look to other countries, it's not just expanded to your own say, okay? The search and the background check are also expanded to your surrounding.
Dr. Frederick Lemieux is a criminologist at Georgetown University. Cindy Combs is with us from UNC Charlotte, a terrorism expert. Why hasn't the word terrorism been mentioned in this case? We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Miles McClellan Construction, dedicated to meeting each of their clients' needs when it comes to project performance and its technical requirements. More info about Miles McClellan's approach at mmbuildings.com. And Biggs Camera, committed to the needs of professional and amateur photographers since 1959, offering new and used cameras as well as full online printing services, rentals, and more. Details at biggscamera.com. Terror in the streets of Las Vegas. We're talking about it. They'll be talking about it in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point. How should Americans understand and confront the now drumbeat of mass killings in this country? Tom Ashbrook and his guest will be talking about that in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The Rohingya people of Myanmar are pouring into neighboring Bangladesh telling
stories. It's your community. We help you understand it.
And now CMPD says it will finish internal investigations even if the officer leaves the department. The chief says he welcomes and...
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the shooting in Las Vegas and the mounting number of mass shootings, this latest on Sunday night being the deadliest in American history. Dr. Frederick Lemieux is a criminologist and professor of the practice of and director of the Masters in Applied Intelligence at Georgetown University. He's joining us by phone from Washington. Cindy Combs is a professor of political science and an expert in homeland security and terrorism at UNC Charlotte. She's been on this program many times to talk about terrorism, a word that has not been mentioned in this instance in Las Vegas. And I'd like to know why, because this man killed close to 60 people. He injured 500 people. That's not terrorism?
It did create a mood of fear, no question. And it was in the audience that he was playing to. It was a violent act. What it lacked in terms of the definition of terrorism as used in both the CIA, State Department, all of them have slightly different definitions, but all of them say that it's done for political or social motives, that it's not simply a bad day, a lost at the card table, and I'm going to take it out.
But
it
we're losing more people to these acts of terrorism. I don't care what they call it.
This
is terrorism. So we're losing more people to these acts than we are to terrorist acts. And yet we have a whole bureaucracy and a bunch of policies and procedures, and law enforcement is all focused on people coming in on airplanes, and yet we've got them right here. And they're slipping through the cracks. Why?
Because it's a lone wolf. Whether you call it a lone wolf terrorist or a lone wolf mass murderer.
What's the difference? A lone wolf, we're worried about lone wolf terrorists.
It's a lot harder to track than any group you'll ever deal with. Groups have organizations and structure and somebody who approves the plans that you're doing. So there's, in effect, a structure there. An individual decides on his own or her own to carry out an act, equips themselves to do it, and does it.
Well, you're the terrorism expert here, and I know that there is an apparatus among law enforcement,
right,
particularly in major cities, and among the federal law enforcement bureaucracies that look for and try to follow and detect lone wolf terrorists,
right,
using their definition of terrorists. Are they successful at it?
Actually, no. We've been able to identify some. And if you take a look at the FBI's website, they explain the terrorist attacks they prevented by arresting this person ahead.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is, for every one they are able to stop, there only has to be one that slips through to carry out a mass murder.
And it's difficult to prove a negative.
It is. And the other half of it is this. There have to be flags that come up to look for. If you're looking for only those who are connecting on the web to ISIS or something like this, you're going to miss someone like this guy because he doesn't connect.
Are there similar ways that we could try at least to pinpoint some of these people and catch them before they do something like this, or is it just a wasted effort?
I believe it is. That's why I mentioned before the one flag is creating a personal arsenal, says that should be a person of interest, not to go and arrest and break up and gather his weapons. But this is a person of interest who then is someone that they would be tracking and looking at. You also have things that they've tried to look at in terms of a profile. There's no personal profile for any given terrorist, but you have to have been, to some degree at least, alienated because you're turning over all the social norms and killing masses of people you don't know. Okay, so that means that alienation is something that schools and others have tried to focus in helping people understand when someone's stepping so far out. Is there something wrong and can we help?
You and I are old enough to remember a time in America where these incidents, be they terrorist incidents by foreign infiltrators or terrorism acts that were perpetrated by sympathizers in this country, would have been unthinkable. It would not have happened. And where I remember the first act like this was the shooting from the tower at Texas A&M, I believe it was.
That's right.
And this country was stunned. It's hard to describe the reaction today because people don't understand it. This country came to a standstill because of it, because we couldn't fathom it. And now you have 59 people being killed, 500 being injured in just the latest in an ongoing series of these instances, and we turn on Will and Grace.
Part of it is that getting, in effect, used to the idea. Do you realize over 20 or 25 years we've gotten used to the idea that individuals will do something like McVeigh did in Oklahoma City or like Paddock did here? It's also true that in order to change the pattern, you have to change a culture. And we'd rather have liberty than security. We've made that trade.
We would rather have liberty than security 35, 45 years ago.
Yes.
And we didn't have these incidents. So what is going on that not just with us as people who watch this unfold, but by the people who are doing these things? Dr. Lemire?
Let me interject here, and I want to build on what Cindy is saying. First of all, to your first question regarding mass shooting versus terrorism. Terrorism is a crime against the state. When ISIS sponsored or inspired someone here, ISIS challenged the United States government and our way of living and they bring that to the mix. And that's why the response of the state, no matter those incidents are very rare, even rarer than mass shooting, are taking seriously. It's a crime against the state. It's challenging the state's apparatus. And that's why they reply so organized and so forcefully. A mass shooting is not a crime against the state. Most likely, no social, no political message going with that. The people are killed just for the kick of it. It's what is in the head of the individuals. There's no social message or political message going with that. There's nothing that challenges state. And that's why, it's a crime. It's just like a common mass homicide. And that's it. So those are the major difference that drives resources and attention of the state from one phenomenon to the other one. I would put that in the balance.
Were guns less available in this country in the 1950s and the 1960s than they are today? Were high-velocity weapons, automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, less available in the 1950s and 60s than they are today? Is that leading to this? Or is it simply copycats? The increasing frequency is leading to increase. It's like a snowball. It's leading to increasing frequency.
It's an amplification effect. As you begin to see it happen, it becomes more common and more acceptable and more useful. They're not more available. In fact, if you'll remember, after Oklahoma City and some of the other pieces, you had been able up until then in like the Rose's stores in Florida to buy automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We closed down a lot of those pieces and made it more difficult, but you didn't stop the idea that you needed it. In fact, you accelerated because you felt less safe. Feel less safe, go buy a gun to be safe. Not logical, but that's what happened.
We have a comment from somebody about silencers, which came up earlier in the program. The suppressors are legal in North Carolina already for hunting. Alex writes, why does the NRA lobby so strongly against having the CDC actually study gun violence if they don't think that something bad will come of the studies? They're not allowed to study that, evidently.
Right.
It feels like they want to keep the data hidden because they know it will result in gun restrictions. But if we study this and it shows that it's not actually guns that are the problem, but possibly people, then the NRA would benefit from it. Their resistance to science feels really fishy to me. In fact, gun advocates have said for a long time that we live in a culture of violence and that guns aren't responsible for that violence. People are, and that having a gun might help you protect yourself from other people who have guns with violent intent in using them. Is that philosophy wrong? And if so, why?
As my colleague pointed out, anyone in the audience who had had a gun would not have been able to protect themselves against the mass shooter. So having a gun doesn't necessarily...
In this case.
Yes, but if you're looking at mass shootings, you're not looking at the very real probability that having a gun in that mass audience is not going to make you safe.
Yeah, and also, like, as CDC did a couple of studies before that ban of using, you know, public money to do the studies on gun happen, and they published some results in, I think it was in 2009, 2008, and 2007, and they published, like, risk and prevalence of death in household having guns versus household not having guns. And the exposure to a weapon, a firearm in a house, not linked to any mass shooting, increase your risk of death tremendously, especially if it's a handgun. Handgun increased by 21% your risk of dying by firearm before you die from cancer or anything else if you have a handgun in your home. It's unbelievable, but those statistics are available, and of course, this is something that the NRA don't want to see out there.
Tracy wants to know if when you buy a gun at a gun shop, do they have a way of knowing how many guns you own or have bought in the past, or do they keep track of the number of guns you're buying from them on a frequent basis, and does it matter?
The shop itself may keep a record of how many you buy from them.
But would they question, if you come in repeatedly and you buy more and more and more and more automatic weapons and more and more and more and more ammunition, do they get suspicious, or do they report you in some way for investigatory purposes? Or do they just say, okay, here it is, hand over the money?
Realistically, they're not expected to report it, and therefore they would be turning away sales.
Mm-hmm.
If we made them aware that you have a responsibility to keep track, and if something comes up that is a flag, you should let someone know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not even a culture that says that, much less a rule. No.
Michael?
Yeah, there's no obligation to that. And in fact, it was a real problem, especially on the southwest border with strawman purchases for the cartels in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are examples where, like, the gun problem spills, you know, over, you know, the mass shootings, and talk about, like, you know, how easy it is to buy guns in the U.S. can fuel, like, you know, like wars, gang wars in Mexico, for example.
Michael writes, all 100% of people walking away from gun stores have had a background check prior to just walking away from the store. It's the law. True even at gun shows, by the way. All dealers with a federal firearms license, regardless of state or sales location, must comply with background check laws before firearms can be transferred, period. But we have stories in the media, with video proving it, that at these gun shows particularly, people go to the trunks of their cars and say, oh, you're looking for that? Well, I've got one in my trunk. I'll sell it to you. We have a black market for guns. I'm told it's easy to get a firearm if you know where to go and who to get it from. So even the legitimate vendors who sell these firearms, we can't control the illegitimate ones, can we?
No, but you're not so much worried just about the illegitimate. You realize the person who did the thing in Las Vegas was a legitimate firearm owner. He passed all the tests.
Yeah.
He had no problem. So if we only focus on catching the bad guys who are breaking the laws, we're missing the point.
Plus, there are so many guns in America. Do we know how many guns per person we have in America? Do we know? Is there a statistic on that?
Well, I mean, technically, if you want to deduct, but I mean, they say that, you know, like there is 8.8 out of 10 households that has guns in it.
Okay.
It is not necessarily transferable like that, because a phenomenon that we observe after, I would say, 2004, 2005, is there is more concentration like that, guys. So there's still the same amount of number, or roughly the same amount of number of legal guns on the streets, but these tends to concentrate more and more in single pair of hands. So we have, like, those phenomenon where you have, like, several people not having guns, but, you know, a handful of people having, like, 43 long guns. So you have that also happening right now. It's a shift in the statistics since 2005, 2004.
Well, we have a lot of guns out there. Some of them are registered and legally purchased. Many of them are not registered, nor are they legally purchased. So if we really wanted to get control of this. If we were willing to change our minds about the Second Amendment and pass highly restrictive gun laws and do ever more diligent background checks on people, would it work with all the illegitimate firearms floating around out there? Could we ever really get a handle on this at this point?
Well, I wrote an interesting article that has been published in 2015 comparing how Australia handled this gun problem and how U.S. is doing it. And interestingly enough, they put a gun ban, so to speak. That's how they called it in Australia. And they did buybacks operation, like giving the government was buying back guns that were like in the house that were not serving because they were passed from, you know, a father to a son or a grandfather to a son, and so on. So they did that, and they were able to buy back all the guns that were, you know, like floating out there, were legal, but, you know, like not necessarily being in use and maybe like subject to robbery or anything or anything else. And it worked. I mean, data to prove it, in terms of restricting those guns, it impacted overall homicide. It impacted overall death by gun. I'm talking about accident. And of course, they did not experience, this mass shooting that they got since it happened in Port Archer, you know. So I think there's a way to do that that could work.
In an editorial this morning in the Charlotte Observer, they write, "It's notable that experts of war and law enforcement tell us that it is hard to train a person to take the life of a fellow human being, that for some of our history, soldiers on the front lines of active wars would refuse to shoot at the enemy, even if it meant that they themselves would be killed." Then they ask, "How did we create a society in which more than 33,000 people are taken by gun violence every year?" The Onion, which is a publication that devotes itself regularly to humor and satire, ran this article yesterday titled, "No Way to Prevent This, Says Only Nation Where This Regularly Happens." And they go on to say, "At press time, residents of the only economically advanced nation in the world, where roughly 2 mass shootings have occurred every month for the past 8 years, were referring to themselves and their situation as helpless." That is satire, but it has a sting. So could we prevent these things, Cindy, without subverting the Constitution?
I believe we could. If our ally Australia can do it legally, not a matter of going house to house and looking for or closing it down, legally, we're as smart as they are. We can manage that.
Cindy Combs is professor of political science and an expert in homeland security and terrorism at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Frederick Lemieux, criminologist and professor of the practice of and director of the Masters in Applied Intelligence at Georgetown University. And when you send us that information about that publication, Doctor, we'll post it on our website at wfae.org. Thank you both for the hour.